Now the NPR Cities Project explores how communities are rethinking their proximity to water in light of rising seas.
We have to make sure that our cities are safe.
How are we going to maintain a city?
Location, location, location.
If other cities can do it, we can do it.
When a hurricane causes severe damage to a city, it often raises the question of whether people should have been living in the worst affected areas in the first place. And should they then be allowed to return? For some in New York City, nearly 2 years after Hurricane Sandy, the answer to those questions is no. In Staten Island, the state is tearing hundreds of houses down. Here's Matthew Sherman of member station WNYC.
I'm here in the Fox Beach neighborhood, a few hundred feet from the Atlantic Ocean, or rather, the former Fox Beach neighborhood. This used to be a working-class area, roughly 180 homes, mostly small bungalows, far away from the hustle and bustle of Manhattan. But for the past year, the state has been tearing down these homes. The latest to go, as you can hear behind me, is number 16 Kissimmee Avenue. Bill Bye used to live there.
It's a strong roof. Was a strong roof, I should say.
After Hurricane Sandy hit in 2012, Bye and other homeowners decided their neighborhood was dangerous in terms of natural disasters and increasingly expensive.
The insurance would be too high. The property tax, everything would be too high.
The backhoe nibbles away at the house, bit by bit, using its shovel to first knock the roof boards loose, pluck away the gutter, nudge the brick chimney. Within an hour, the whole thing comes down. The woman who lives next door, Franca Costa, is staying, at least for now.
I don't know if they're offering me enough money where I could buy something else for us. I mean, the guy down there moved into a studio. I don't want to do something like that once I've owned a house.
Costa is one of only a few holdouts left. It's not just because of Sandy. This is wetlands. It floods in heavy rains and is barely above sea level. In hot weather, wildfires break out.
If you look at what we're in the midst of right here, you realize houses don't belong here.
That's Joe Tyrone. I talked to him a little ways down the street, where workers are removing the cement slab of another house. He organized the neighbors and convinced New York State to buy out whoever wanted to sell.
It's insane to think that this looked like this 30 or 40 years ago, and someone said, oh, I can build some homes here.
The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, embraced the buyouts. He's devoted $600 million of federal Sandy relief money to the project. That'll cover roughly 750 homes, not just here in Fox Beach, but at other sites on Staten Island and on Long Island as well. Environmentalists say the money is well worth it.
In our DC, how may I direct your call?
To ask why, I went to the headquarters of the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's in Manhattan, about 15 miles from Fox Beach. Eric Goldstein is a senior attorney.
The problem is a national problem. Population in coastal counties is increasing. More property and more lives are at risk now along the coast in terms of endangerment and future storms than perhaps ever before.
The idea of buyouts, or retreating from flood-prone areas, took root about 20 years ago. Government agencies calculated in some cases it would cost less money than repeatedly bailing out the same homeowners for every flood.
Living along the coast and having an ocean view is very enticing. Unfortunately, there are some coastal areas where that is problematic.
Back on Staten Island, where more than 40 homes have been torn down so far, the buyouts are not only removing people from dangerous areas, they are creating open space that will act as a buffer to blunt the force and absorb some of the water of the next storm surge. Rebecca Sinclair works for the New York State Governor's Office of Storm Recovery.
It should be actually a rather peaceful place where you could come and walk and view different wildlife. I mean, I think there's real potential here.
Here in Fox Beach, nature is already returning. The reeds have grown more than 10 feet tall in places. People see deer, herons, and hawks regularly. The former residents have moved upland to higher ground, sometimes just a few blocks, but far enough back to be out of harm's way for the next storm. On Kissimmee Avenue in Staten Island, I'm Matthew Sherman for the NPR Cities Project.
And you can follow the Cities Project on Twitter at NPR Cities.
Thousands of environmental activists from around the world are expected to march in New York City tomorrow. Organizers of the People's Climate March say it will be the largest climate change demonstration in history. They're trying to send a message to world leaders, gathering for the United Nations Climate Summit next week, NPR's Joel Rose reports.
The biggest previous climate change protest was 5 years ago in Copenhagen, where an estimated 100,000 people showed up. The organizers of the People's Climate March hope to crush that record.
Hi, join us for the march on Sunday. Great, great. Hope you can make the march.
Marilyn Vasta is handing out flyers in Midtown Manhattan. She's part of the host committee that spent 5 months organizing tomorrow's march, along with more than 1,400 schools, faith groups, and other organizations.
I think if we have a massive turnout, it will really say to world leaders, people get this, you can't be a world leader if you're doing nothing about the biggest crisis that civilization has ever faced. You're not leading.
Those leaders are gathering for a UN climate summit next week at the invitation of Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The goal is to work toward international agreements that would lower greenhouse gas emissions. So far, that's been a tough sell with many governments, including the U.S.
We won the argument 20 years ago. Science is not in doubt. We've just lost the fight.
Bill McGibbon is a writer, professor, and activist who led the call for the massive march in New York. There will be no speeches, no stage, no celebrity headliners. McGibbon says the size of the march is the message, and the protesters are encouraged to bring trumpets, whistles, and anything else that makes noise.
We're going to sound the climate alarm. We're going to sound the smoke alarm for a planet on fire. We're going to make a hell of a lot of noise. The time has come for these guys to stop talking and offering fine speeches and start actually doing something.
What matters as much as how many people show up in the march is what happens the day after.
Moises Naim is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says most street protests don't work. He points to Occupy Wall Street as an example of a protest that had no specific demands and therefore little concrete impact. Naim is concerned that the agenda of this climate march is similarly vague.
Because they're not connected with a political machine. There is a lot of energy in that street, a lot of people with a lot of passion. But in effect, they're not targeting anyone concretely, because when you target everyone, you're not targeting anyone specific.
But the Climate March's organizers say it's already built connections that will help them ahead of next year's big climate conference in Paris. And they say they're inspired by past protests that did leave a mark on history, like the Civil Rights March on Washington in 1963. That's what motivates demonstrator Kim Morrow. She and her daughter rode the train to New York this week from Nebraska.
People turn out in the streets when the issue boils over to that level of just absolutely demanding change to happen. And now we're seeing that climate change is the most pressing moral issue of our time.
Organizers say they're expecting more than 400 buses full of protesters from around the country. Even UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will walk with the demonstrators. They hope the sound of the march will still be ringing in the ears of world leaders when the climate summit opens on Tuesday. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
World leaders are converging in New York for the United Nations Climate Summit, and thousands of environmentalists have gathered in New York as well. The event is billed as the People's Climate March, and tens of thousands of activists, church groups, actors, and politicians are marching through the streets of Manhattan. Joining me now from New York is NPR's Joel Rose. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Wade.
This has turned into a massive protest. You're on the streets with the marchers. What are you seeing and hearing?
It's very big. It is orderly, at least from where I can tell, and it is loud. I've counted two marching bands, at least three drum circles, air horns, trumpets, you name it, and all kinds of signs for pretty much every kind of environmental cause you could name. There are more than 1,400 groups involved in organizing this march, schools and faith groups, to businesses, nonprofits. So it's a big tent. The organizers said that the biggest climate march before this one was 100,000 people, and that they're confident that this one will be bigger. We won't know that officially for a little while yet, but it is certainly large.
So organizers are getting the numbers they expected?
It's hard to be precise. I mean, the protesters lined up for the march on Central Park West, and the police had blocked off almost 30 blocks of the park, and they were just full. The street was closed, and protesters had filled the street for block after block after block. So it's certainly a big march. Whether they're going to get to the 100,000 number or not is an open question. But I mean, in any case, they got quite a turnout.
Let's talk about what the marchers want.
Well, with so many groups involved, there are a number of different causes. As I said, you see signs for all kinds of things. But I think the one overarching concern people have here is they want action on climate change. There's a sense of frustration. People feel that the science on what is causing climate change has been clear for a long time, and they want to see concrete action from world leaders to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, that's something that the world leaders gathering here for the United Nations Climate Summit on Tuesday will discuss, but concrete action has eluded them in the past, and, that's something that the protesters here very much want to see.
Is there a feeling that this is going to have an impact on the UN Climate Summit next week?
That's really a big question hanging over all of this is, you know, even if they get the number that they want, what difference will it make inside the halls of the UN when they start to actually talk about these very difficult issues? I don't think anyone expects that they're suddenly going to reach a breakthrough on Tuesday or Thursday or whatever, but I think the hope is that this giant protest will help build sort of a grassroots movement that will continue to put pressure on world leaders here and abroad as they sort of hammer out some of the difficult details moving towards this next UN Climate Summit in Paris, at the UN Climate Conference in Paris late next year.
That's NPR's Joel Rose in Manhattan. Thanks so much, Joel.
You're welcome, Wade.
World leaders are converging in New York for the United Nations Climate Summit, and thousands of environmentalists have gathered in New York as well. The event is billed as the People's Climate March, and tens of thousands of activists, church groups, actors, and politicians are marching through the streets of Manhattan. Joining me now from New York is NPR's Joel Rose. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Wade.
This has turned into a massive protest. You're on the streets with the marchers. What are you seeing and hearing?
It's very big. It is orderly, at least from where I can tell, and it is loud. I've counted two marching bands, at least three drum circles, air horns, trumpets, you name it, and all kinds of signs for pretty much every kind of environmental cause you could name. There are more than 1,400 groups involved in organizing this march, schools and faith groups, businesses, nonprofits. So it's a big tent. The organizer said that the biggest climate march before this one was 100,000 people, and that they're confident that this one will be bigger. We won't know that officially for a little while yet, but it is certainly large.
So organizers are getting the numbers they expected?
Well, it's hard to be precise. I mean, the protesters lined up for the march on Central Park West, and the police had blocked off almost 30 blocks of the park. And they were just full, the street was closed, and protesters had filled the street for block after block after block. So it's certainly a big march. Whether they're going to get to the 100,000 number or not is an open question. But, I mean, in any case, they got quite a turnout.
Let's talk about what the marchers want.
Well, with so many groups involved, there are a number of different causes. As I said, you see signs for all kinds of things. But I think the one overarching concern people have here is they want action on climate change. There's a sense of frustration. People feel that the science on what is causing climate change has been clear for a long time, and they want to see concrete action from world leaders to limit greenhouse gas emissions. That's something that the world leaders gathering here for the United Nations Climate Summit on Tuesday will discuss, But concrete action has eluded them in the past, and that's something that the protesters here very much want to see.
Is there a feeling that this is going to have an impact on the UN climate summit next week?
That's really a big question hanging over all of this. Is, you know, even if they get the number that they want, what difference will it make inside the halls of the UN when they start to actually talk about these very difficult issues? I don't think anyone expects that they're suddenly going to reach a breakthrough on Tuesday or Thursday or whatever, but I think the hope is that this giant protest will help build sort of a grassroots movement that will continue to put pressure on world leaders here and abroad as they sort of hammer out some of the difficult details moving towards this next UN climate summit in Paris, at the UN climate conference in Paris late next year.
That's NPR's Joel Rose in Manhattan. Thanks so much, Joel.
You're welcome, Wade.
Forecast calls for perfect weather tomorrow in New York as world leaders talk about the climate. President Obama joins more than 120 leaders at a United Nations climate summit.
The world leaders were given homework in advance of the meeting. The UN told them to show up with bold ideas in hand to slow the rise in global temperatures.
Whatever their ideas, they are meeting in a country with deeply divided views of global warming. Partisan differences have sharply slowed the U.S. government's response.
But it was in New York that an estimated 300,000 climate activists marched through the streets yesterday.
They were pushing the world leaders to act. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Yesterday's demonstration, dubbed the People's Climate March, was intended to turn up the heat on a UN process that's sometimes glacially slow. Alana Selectina was part of a sizable contingent who marched from Columbia University.
It's really exciting. I've never seen so much energy around an issue. People just seem ready to take on the world leaders who haven't been doing anything on climate change.
Climate experts say there's little time to waste. A surge in carbon dioxide last year pushed greenhouse gas levels to an all-time high. And according to the National Climate Assessment, the last decade was the hottest on record in the United States. This spring, President Obama told WLTX television in South Carolina it's not too late to turn things around.
That's something we can do, but only if the American people push Washington to do it, because typically, politicians are wary about doing something on their own, particularly if they're not sure that the public supports it.
And Americans are deeply divided, not only about how to address climate change, but whether it's a problem at all. Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center says in a poll last month, 68% of Democrats called climate change a major threat to the United States, concern on a par with Islamic extremism. But only 25% of Republicans feel that way.
It's one of the most partisan issues we track. Republicans just simply do not see it as an imminent problem for the United States, but Democrats by and large do.
Even among Democrats, there's disagreement about how far to go in controlling greenhouse gases. Many Democrats from big coal-producing areas, for example, are not happy with the president's planned EPA regulations clamping down on coal-fired power plants. Kentucky Senate candidate Allison Lundergan Grimes has tried to distance herself from Obama's proposal.
I'm not Barack Obama. I disagree with him on guns, coal, and the EPA.
But if action on climate change is a liability with some voters, Democrats hope to make it an asset with others. Chris Lehane is a Democratic strategist for a climate super PAC that's pumping money from billionaire Tom Steyer into half a dozen close contests around the country.
In many of these campaigns, climate was being used as a wedge issue focused against Republicans. And that, to me, is a real sign that climate politics is on the move and on the move in a good direction.
Lehane says climate issues resonate with young voters and, if properly framed, with African Americans and Latinos, precisely the groups most likely to sit out the midterm elections. Lehane says a climate message can help mobilize those voters if it's presented not as an esoteric issue about polar bears, but a close-to-home concern such as drought, smokestack pollution, or the rising cost of flood insurance.
You do need to bring it down to the kitchen table so that people actually understand the impact it's having on them, their families, their kids, on a daily existence. And when you do that, it's an entirely different conversation. And people are motivated in terms of who they're going to vote and whether or not they're going to turn out to vote.
The outcome of those November contests will help determine how much of a weapon climate action or inaction may be in future U.S. political campaigns. This week's New York summit is designed to set the stage for another round of international climate negotiations in Paris next year. The White House says President Obama will be in a better position to lead that effort if he's able to set an example here at home. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Rockefeller family made its vast fortune in the oil business over a century ago. Now the Rockefeller Brothers Fund is planning to divest itself entirely from fossil fuels. Yuki Noguchi reports on how the family's giant philanthropic foundation is parting ways with its business legacy.
John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s five sons and the original Standard Oil magnate's grandsons started the fund in 1940. It had a social change agenda promoting peace and justice and sustainability. A tenth of its nearly $900 million in assets are currently invested in clean energy. Stephen Hines is the fund's president.
There is something ironic about having all this wealth that was created in the oil industry now being used to move to a different energy future.
But Hines says about 6% of the fund's investments remain in fossil fuels, which it hopes to reduce to almost nothing.
This is a process that is an imperative. We have to do this.
The Rockefeller Fund is among some 50 philanthropies announcing at today's UN Summit on Climate Change that they are joining other groups divesting from fossil fuels, including the Bullitt Foundation. Ellen Dorsey is executive director of the Wallace Global Fund, one of the first groups to join the movement and one of its organizers. She says it may be a largely symbolic gesture now, but the impact can't yet be measured by the number of dollars committed to divest in old energy and invest in new.
It's signaling that we need to begin to plan for a future without fossil fuels and that money will be made in this transition.
Dorsey says she hopes the number of groups and individuals joining the pledge will double by the end of next year. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.